Wow. Well, good evening, 10th. It is really great to be here. You know, I arrived yesterday. My luggage did not. You know, I just recently moved from, traveled from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I was there. It took me about 16 different flights. My luggage carried on, came with me the whole way. But when I flew yesterday from Calgary to Vancouver, gone. It eventually arrived late last night. However, I had to go out. So my wardrobe today is courtesy of Winners and Air Canada. I also just want to say that it's really great to be at this evening service. Ken, you were talking about my father a couple of minutes ago. I have, in my church growing up, my Baptist church, we went to church on Sunday morning and Sunday evening and Wednesday evenings. But the Sunday evening service was always really special because I just have this memory of sitting next to my dad, sort of snuggling up to him as the song went on. It was always a bit more informal. Chances are I fell asleep. But it's just this wonderful sense of God's presence and a really warm memory that came back to me as you were talking about my dad. So thank you, and thanks for letting me be here. Will you join me as I open in prayer? God, as we gather here in this place, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. In Jesus' name, amen. Wow, the opportunity to start a new series with you on practicing God's economy. We're going to look at elements of that today. How this economy is upside down, it's different. It's a kingdom that's backwards, but with a new king. I just want to start, though, by saying a real thank you to 10th Church for a couple of things. First of all, you have been amazing partners with World Vision. We've been really privileged to have you come and see some of our work in Cambodia. We're one of your Cambodia partners. Maybe one of your learning teams will see some of our work when we're there. But I also benefit every board meeting from one of my bosses, one of the members of my board of directors, who is Ken Shigematsu. So I get to benefit from his leadership, his wisdom, his experience, and his faith. And I'm deeply grateful for you loaning him to World Vision. Well, our big idea today is this. Following Jesus leads us to the margins of our world. The world has margins. What do we mean by that? Well, let's go back to a really critical original source. And that is a Disney movie. You all know The Lion King. The Lion King came out in 1994, about 5 years before my two kids were born. But by the time they were there and as they were growing up, the Lion King DVD was a staple in our DVD player. We played it all the time. So I've got fond memories of being with our kids and watching The Lion King, so much so that this summer my wife and I went to see the live action version of The Lion King at a drive-in theater. Two adults, no kids, nowhere to be seen, just us reliving those moments of childhood. The reason I'm talking about this is that there is a scene in The Lion King that gives us a little bit of a glimpse of what we mean by margins. It's this one. Little Simba, if I need to tell you the plot, you probably understand this. Little Simba is the king-to-be, the heir apparent, and Mufasa is the Lion King. The first day of this little cub's education and what it means to be the new king started. He wakes up his dad, they go to the top of Pride Rock, and the first thing that Mufasa does is let Simba look out over the entire kingdom. Do you remember the scene? This is what Mufasa says. I'm going to try to get my best James Earl Jones voice here. Someday, Simba. How's that? Okay. Someday, Simba, the sun will set on my time and will rise for you as the new king. And Simba says, and all this will be mine? Mufasa says, everything the light touches. Everything the light touches, Simba says. But then he looks out across the vast plain and he says, but what about those dark, those shadowy places over there? And Mufasa quickly turns quite stern and turns to Simba and says, those are beyond our borders and you must never go there. Of course, Simba does go there. That's sort of the whole story. But what we mean by that is that these are the margins. Did you ever receive a Mufasa-like warning from someone in your life? I certainly did. To get to school in Moncton, New Brunswick, where I grew up, it was about a 2-kilometer walk if you stayed on the road. I tell my kids that it was uphill both ways. But the fact is that we could take a shortcut, but the shortcut meant that we'd have to cross the road and go into a wilderness park and walk through this dark woods and past and through an abandoned day camp. It was actually pretty scary. Doesn't matter what the weather was like outside, it was always dark, there was usually wildlife, and every so often somebody, you know, a person living in poverty was there. So we were told by my parents not to ever go there. They were concerned, of course, for our safety, because you see, margins are shadowy places. They're often difficult contexts, dangerous environments, and more frequently than you think, often full of desperate people. At World Vision, we are kind of wired to want to go to the margins. It's part of our organizational DNA. We've got a vision statement and a mission statement, but probably one of the most significant moments for us was when our founder, Bob Pierce, who was an evangelist and a war correspondent, was struck by the poverty he experienced as he was also bringing spiritual guidance to people in Korea and China. He wrote in the flyleaf of his Bible this phrase, "May my heart be broken by the things that break the heart of God." People in the margins, those living on the edges, are among the things that we believe break God's heart. I have the opportunity to travel with World Vision and see some of these difficult places. Probably one of the most marginal places on earth in the world today is a place called the Central African Republic. This is one of the places that World Vision is doing ministry in, and I had a chance to visit there earlier this year. I'd like to give you a little bit of a glimpse of life in Kar. And the best way I can do that is by sharing with you a couple of the stories and videos that we shot while we were in Central African Republic. So come with me now, take the next 3 minutes, and let's go see what life in the margins looks like in our world today. Take a look.
Kar, Central African Republic. This is a country that barely makes the news. A country many people don't even know exists. It's here that fighting between Christian and Muslim armed groups, the Seleka and Anti-Balaka, plunged the country into chaos years ago. But things have gotten worse. In 2018, the Central African Republic was rated one of the saddest countries on earth. What's happening today isn't just because of Muslim and Christian tensions. These armed groups also clash over the control of resources like diamonds and gold. They take territory by violently attacking villages, killing hundreds of people, burning farms, and recruiting children to join their forces.
Déjà l'enfant qui a quitté 12 ans à l'école, il a déjà 18 ans, il est déjà majeur. Il demande être réintégré dans la société.
Ça c'est mes derniers à la famille mise à cuire. Bon, ça c'est mon jambe bumbi, ma bigola pour porter ta nuit sans cœur. Nambi iso asazo nambi na beti mi anje na mepe. Men na sango iso asiga gasa sula si.
The crisis in Kar is overwhelming, but it's not like other emergencies. This is a long-standing, forgotten crisis. For any stability to occur, long-term programs tackling the root causes of conflict are required. World Vision has brought together Christian and Muslim faith leaders who are working to break down religious divisions created by armed groups. Even in the midst of chaos, there are pockets of change. In remote villages, child soldiers have been freed from armed groups. Through peace clubs, these youth learn how to promote peace in their communities. Together with World Vision, religious leaders are creating farming groups that work across the lines of faith to promote acceptance between Muslims and Christians. Peace is literally being grown from the ground up. Applaud.
Some of the images and stories that you see there, and we've just sort of scratched the surface, frankly, are really hard to watch. It's hard to understand, but we believe these things break God's heart. We believe that actually, as a Christian organization, we have to be there because we believe that Jesus is in the margins. We're going to look at a verse in the scripture today in the book of John, just one example of where Jesus went to the margins. We're going to explore that together. In fact, we're just going to, it's amazing. It's just the beginning of a story that is worth a whole sermon on its own in John chapter 4. It's a story that many of you are familiar with, and that's Jesus interacting with the Samaritan woman at the well. So I'd like to start with this and read this. I'm going to encourage you as we just read these five verses that are the beginning of this story. There is a lot packed in to this section. So we're going to look and see what Jesus is doing, what kind of things he's saying, who he's talking to. But let's also think about what the gospel writer John includes in this introduction to set the stage for us, to help us to understand even more deeply what it means to follow Jesus to the margins. So John chapter 4, starting at verse 4. He, that's Jesus, had to go through Samaria on the way. Eventually he came to the Samaritan village of Sychar, near the field that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired from the long walk, sat wearily beside the well about noontime. Soon a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Please give me a drink." He was alone at the time because his disciples had gone to buy food into the village. The woman was surprised, for Jews refused to have anything to do with Samaritans. She said to Jesus, "You are a Jew. I'm a Samaritan woman. Why are you asking me for a drink?" The answer to that question, of course, goes on in the rest of John, and we won't get there today, but even just up until that point of that question, we can learn a whole lot. First of all, let me give you a little bit of background. Jesus had been down in Judea in the south, and he had been preaching and had been baptizing, and there had been a bit of a rumor going on that Jesus was baptizing more people than John the Baptist. And for some reason, that was a real concern. And so Jesus decided to go with his disciples from Judea up to Galilee. Now, a few things to remember. First of all, Jews and Samaritans were not friends. In fact, you could say that they were enemies at this time. They were in the margins of each other. Even though from the outside, say, the Roman occupiers might have looked at the Jews and Samaritans and thought, oh, they're pretty similar looking, kind of, they worship the same, they talk the same language, they kind of live in the same way. For the Jews and Samaritans, there were some fundamental differences, particularly about religion. What holy book to use, where the temple should be, so where worship should happen. But needless to say that a good Jew in AD 33 did not associate with Samaritans. That's why stories like later on in the parable of the Good Samaritan is so significant, because it kind of puts the roles in different ways. They imagine the Samaritan actually being good. So that's the context that we come to this story. So we start right at the beginning and ask, the very first phrase says, Jesus had to go to Samaria. Let me just give you a sense of the geography biblically at this time. So we've got the Mediterranean Sea kind of over here, all right, to the west. Judea is down here. Jesus wants to go from here to Galilee, which is up here in the north. The problem is that right between Judea and Galilee is Samaria. So the shortcut, the quickest way from Judea to Galilee is straight through Samaria. But you see, the problem is that a good Jew didn't associate with Samaritans. Sure, there were some people who took the shortcut in the same way that I did going through the park. But you certainly didn't stop and linger or have a conversation with somebody at a well. You made your way right through and hoped to avoid the Samaritans on the way. So why is it that the scripture says that Jesus had to go to Samaria? He didn't. Because in fact, let me put it this way. Some of you are younger in the audience, in the congregation today. If Jesus had a smartphone and used Google Maps, these are the settings that he would use. Avoid tolls, avoid highways, avoid Samaria. And if he did that, it would show him that he could go and cross the Jordan River and go around to the edge and up inside or maybe skirt the coast. But that's not what Jesus did. So why does it say he had to go there? Well, the word had to or had to go is actually, it is necessary in the Greek, the word day. It is necessary. So why was it necessary for Jesus to have to go there? Well, we know that he didn't have to go there for geographic reasons. He shouldn't have gone there. In fact, one of the handbooks that is often used by Bible translators says this is the same kind of language, this necessity, as you see later on when it says that the Son of Man or Jesus had to be lifted up. This idea that there was a divine necessity is the language that they use. A divine necessity, that is, God willed Jesus to be there at that time, at that moment, to send a message, to meet a person, to start something, but there was a divine requirement. It's not surprising that Jesus is doing things that are following God's will, because in fact, we also need to remember that Jesus is God. That my pastor talks about Jesus being God with skin on. So it's not surprising that the things that are important to God are important to Jesus as well. There's parts in the New Testament where the Pharisees or other religious leaders criticize Jesus for working on the Sabbath. And Jesus replies essentially, "My Father does the work all the time. Why shouldn't I do it too?" He signals this. And we also know, in fact, he tells the disciples later on in John 14:9, the person who sees me sees my Father. So if the Father was going to do something, if the Father had a heart for someone or something, Jesus shared it as well. And we know God's heart toward those on the margins. Jesus would have been steeped in the Hebrew scriptures in places like Deuteronomy, where it says God defends the cause of the fatherless, the widow, and the orphan. He cares for the foreigners residing among you. And there are a number of passages this way. God's heart beats for those in the margins. We also look in this passage and say, again, how John describes where they are. So we know that it was a divine necessity that he be there, that Jesus demonstrated God's heart. But we also learn that these places are nearby some places of significance to the Jews. He could have simply said, "We went to Sychar in Samaria," and that would have been enough. But no, he goes on to say, "Oh, by the way, this is near where Jacob gave to his son Joseph a land, and this well is actually Jacob's well." These are, friends, like big, major A-list players in the history of the Hebrew people. Joseph, Jacob. Why does John include this detail? I believe it's in part because he's making the connection to say, you know what? There is more in common with the people here than you think. In fact, some very fundamental core ideas and identity are linked right here in this place. So watch for that in this story. We also look at that word near or nearby. Did you know that when you talk about being near someone, it's the same word that if you add a "the" in front of the Greek word, it basically becomes the nearby ones. That's the word for neighbor, the nearby ones. So when Jesus says in the Great Commandment, "Love your neighbor as yourself," he's actually saying love the nearby ones as yourself. Once again, the gospel writer is giving us this clue, this signal to say the gap between them and us, others and you, is actually a lot smaller than you think. A divine necessity, following the Father's heart, and the people in the margins are actually our neighbors. And then, of course, the question is, who does Jesus meet? What does he say? And here's an example of where this interaction that he has with the Samaritan woman is fascinating, because in some ways he crosses another whole set of margins. It's like margins within margins. Because we've already got a man, he's now a single man in alone at a well, having a conversation with a single woman who's there by herself. That already is breaching some cultural barriers at the time. But we also know, if you've ever been in part of the developing world around a well, Ken and I were like that in Tanzania, you'll find that generally speaking, a well is a social moment, especially for the women of the community. They come together generally in the cool of the morning or the cool of the evening together to gather water. So we ask ourselves, why is this woman alone? Why is she getting water at noontime? Something is signaling to us that there are telltale signs that this woman herself has been marginalized or ostracized in her own community. We learn that story, of course, going on. But it just shows once again, there's this level of marginalization. But what does Jesus do? Does he ignore her? Does he just kind of hope that she passes by? No, he reaches out to her and interacts with her. And in fact, says something quite personal. He says, "Give me something to drink." And she's astonished by this, of course. Almost, I can imagine her looking around saying, "Did he just talk to me? Like, what? He wants a drink from my ladle?" And she offers it, and that begins the beginning of a relationship where Jesus sees in her a marginalized person, someone of value and relationship, someone on whom he pegs a whole lot of transformation that happens later in the chapter. I'd encourage you to go back and see what happens in John 4. Maybe at some point there'll be another sermon on that. But just packed into this profound introduction, we can learn a lot. We learn that God's heart is in the margins, that God's Son, in perfect imitation of the Father, goes to the margins and engages with the marginalized. And the people in the margins are our neighbors. But this really isn't surprising for us if we step back and look at all of biblical history and all of the story of the New Testament, of the Incarnation. God's gospel is all about margins. Every one of us have been marginalized from God, right? It's because God has crossed over from sin and brokenness to us and reached out to us and brought us in from the margins into the center that we're able to be saved. In Romans 5:8, God shows his love to us by sending his Son to die for us while we were still sinners. 59 days from today is Christmas. Christmas is the celebration where we actually focus on that incarnation, that moment of Christ coming down, stepping out of his center to our margin. And that's what we worship. God's gospel is all about margins. We also know that God's kingdom is all about margins as well. Jesus says, go out. Our faith is not just something that stays here. Go out to the highways and to the byways. Reach out to those in need. Go out to the people that Jesus calls in Matthew 25, the least of these. When that happens, the leper is touched and healed. The adulterer is forgiven. Children are welcomed. We sit at sinners' tables and break bread together. God is the God of the margins. His love reaches to the edges, to those shadowy places, right to the fringes. It won't surprise you to see where we're going here. If we want to follow Jesus, we need to be prepared to go to the margins. Do you know what Christians means? Christian, the word Christian? Yes, it's a follower of Christ. It actually means little Christ. We are to be little Jesuses in our world. In the same way that Jesus imitates his Father, tries to find his heart to do what he does, we are required, we should be doing the same thing as followers of Christ. We want to be Christ-led, Christ-like, and Christ-minded. Now, his disciples are the prime examples of somebody following him, right? They came to him. They went right with him into Samaria. They didn't take the long route and say, we'll meet you at the top. They were right there with him.
But we're equally astonished as we are when we read these stories. When they came back from getting groceries to see Jesus interacting with a Samaritan woman. But yet they were there and said, Jesus is doing something. We want to be part of this. We're disciples too. And we need to respond. Friends, this is huge. This is not a moment of Mufasa saying, don't go to those borders. No, we've got a new king with a new kingdom. The king that actually Jesus is described as the Lion of Judah, calling out to us and saying, I want to set up a new heaven and a new earth. I'm creating a church that will sit on a hill, that will reach out to those in need in acts of mercy and grace and love and hope, and the gates of hell will not prevail against us. Not only do we want to follow Jesus because we have to, but because we should, in our hearts, aligned with him, want to. We want to proclaim the values of this new kingdom. I go to lots of difficult places. I grapple with evil in these places and heartache and difficulty. I keep coming back to these ideas of a new kingdom. Like you see in Isaiah 65, where Jesus said, I am coming to create a new heaven and a new earth. And he paints a picture for us about what that new heavens looks like. He says, no more will children die before they have the opportunity to live up to their full potential. No more will men and women be at conflict with each other. They'll be able to grow food, have houses and shelter, all of those, the comforts that really contribute toward peace. Where relationships are restored, relationships between each other, between humans and creation, and importantly, of course, between God and us. That's the king. The new kingdom we want to follow, and I want to follow that king. Margins are local. They are national, they're global, but all of these are nearby. That's important for us to remember, that when we talk about margins, it doesn't just mean the edges of the earth. We need to be looking for people and places who are marginalized right here. At World Vision, though, we do have a particular calling for some of these most difficult places. One of the places that I think of, one of the stories that I want to share, is from the country of Afghanistan. I was there earlier this year. Incredible challenge and difficulty. And when I was there, I met this little girl. Her name is Banesh. Banesh is 14 years old. She looks younger. We met Banesh in a mobile health clinic in a camp that was set up for internally displaced people in the western part of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been racked by conflict for years. And it's even worse at the moment in this part of Afghanistan because they have been dealing with a terrible drought, causing hundreds of thousands of people to leave their villages, far mountainous regions, and come into these towns, overloading the town's systems and structures. So we are there working in one of these informal camps with a mobile health clinic. And that's where we met Banesh. She was there to get medical care. But here's the thing. Banesh wasn't there with her parents. Banesh was there with her husband. She was there to get the first medical care she's ever received because she was 9 months pregnant with her second baby. Banesh had been married by her parents, sold off essentially at the age of 11. While my daughter Annie was playing with dolls, going to school, dancing, playing, and probably watching The Lion King, Banesh, at the same age, was introduced to a grown-up world that she knew nothing about and was not ready for. We talked to Banesh, and we knew that there wasn't much we could do. We could make sure that her kids were as healthy as they could be in this moment when they were engaging with us. We could teach them about healthy birth spacing and doing those kinds of things to make sure that they can be as healthy as they can. But Banesh said to us, what I want you to do is do all that you can so that my daughter doesn't have to go through what I did. That's the challenge. That's the challenge in these marginal, shadowy places. But Benesh is one of our neighbors. What do we do? How do we respond? Sometimes stories like these can be a bit overwhelming. Maybe you're panicking, saying, oh, is Michael expecting me to kind of hop on a plane and go to Afghanistan and help? No, I'm not. And in fact, I'd really recommend that you don't do that. But there are other ways that we can begin to be wired in our minds and in our hearts the way that Jesus is. One way to think about it is to say, if this is something that touches your heart, how can we provide support to those who are able to reach out? And you know what, let's come right back to the story of the disciples and Jesus in Samaria in the beginning of John 4. You remember it mentioned that the disciples were out buying groceries in the village, getting food? Have you ever wondered where the funds came for them to purchase the food? Well, we know. We can go into the Gospel of Luke. We know that there was a core number of disciples who were working to provide resources to the disciples and Jesus. Interestingly, a lot of them were named their women, who culturally were not able to be on the ground with Jesus walking through the wilderness, but were every bit as important to God's mission in these marginal places. They're actually named. We have Mary the Magdalene, Susanna, and Joanna. Joanna was actually the wife of the chief steward of King Herod, so a wealthy woman. And the Bible says that they actually shared out of their resources, contributed out of their resources towards Jesus's mission. As a result of their support, they became the catalyst for Jesus and the 12 to reach a whole group of people in Samaria, beginning them on their journey toward faith in Jesus. They weren't there in person, but they were every bit as part of that mission. And so we look for opportunities where we can come alongside other organizations or groups that are working with marginalized people to say, is there a way for us to be able to support as well as we give out of our resources? At World Vision, there are ways to connect. And we're really grateful to 10th Church for your partnership with us. World Vision has a program called Child Sponsorship, where we work for long-term community development with children around the world, like these children in Zambia, these girls who are being provided the opportunity for education. Maybe there's parts of being involved in the margins that you really feel fired up around issues of injustice or advocacy. So joining World Vision or other groups to stand up against things like child marriage, or to make decisions on fair trade or ethical sourcing of the clothes that you wear and the food that you eat. Or maybe there's a part of this work that we're talking about, this reach right to the what we call fragile context that really touches you. And World Vision has a program called Raw Hope, where we're adjusting our program models. Just places like South Sudan, where I met with these unbelievably courageous and resilient women who are turning wasteland into a place to grow food for their children, even in the midst of conflict. World Vision's coming alongside. Of course, there are marginalized people right here in Vancouver, in your family, in your communities. We need to look out for them as well. So it's really important. I don't want you to get the wrong idea that the only way for us as Christians to serve people in the margins is to go to those far-flung places or support people, groups like World Vision. The Christian author Frederick Buechner said, "The place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet." And you need to think about what is that sense of calling that you're feeling? Sometimes thinking about these things makes us feel a little uncomfortable. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, reading the scriptures, engaging in this work, is that Jesus doesn't seem to mind making us feel a little bit uncomfortable from time to time. What do we do with that sense of discomfort is the key. How do we respond to those urges, those ideas that are brewing in us to see how we can serve? Will you join us? Here's what we learned today. Margins are messy and risky. Margins can make us feel uncomfortable. The mission of the church as Christians includes those in the margins. margins are closer than you think. In fact, the people there are our neighbors. And Jesus is already there. We want to come alongside the work that he is doing. If we want to follow Jesus, it is necessary, a divine necessity, for us to go to the margins. God's love will lead you in no other direction. So a little simple homework for you. Check out this cause. Think about this. Look for opportunities to connect here at 10th with programs that are helping the marginalized. Maybe it's about asking God to give you fresh eyes to look for those telltale signs of people who are marginalized in your own community or in your own sphere of influence. Reach out to them. And of course, pray. Pray that God will open your hearts and your eyes to see as he does, that his heart will beat like yours, that our hearts will be broken by the things that break God's heart. I'd like to finish with just a final story, once again, taking you back to the Central African Republic. In my many years of traveling with World Vision, I would say that Car was probably the most difficult place I've ever been. There are 14 separate armed groups working in Central African Republic today. The central government only controls about a third of the country. More than half of the population survive on humanitarian assistance. They are displaced people. It is a place of ongoing conflict and violence that feels so deep set that I've never experienced anything like it. It feels dark. I frankly was a bit despairing when I was there. We saw good work, but it felt like a drop in the bucket. But it wasn't until we went to this community on the last day. The last major visit, we were there to have a conversation with faith leaders about how we could help build and plant the seeds of peace in this community to break down those conflict barriers that were keeping people apart. But the first thing that we did was to join a church on Palm Sunday in their morning service. At that moment, God broke through for me. In my Anglican church, when I was younger, we used to get a little palm frond and we'd wave it and walk around the courtyard of the church. Not here. We were given entire branches of palm leaves. 700 people gathered in a procession, and we circled the entire town. 4 kilometers of praise and worship behind the cross, where we said that despite the darkness in this place, light is breaking through. Jesus is doing something amazing, miraculous, that we want to be part of. It was God saying to me, listen, you might feel like you are stuck right here in the midst of evil and darkness, but you need to live, Michael. You need to live according to the values of this coming kingdom. I'm the king of this kingdom. It's a new heaven and a new earth. You may not yet see it, but you need to hold on to those values and live like you do. I came away with this deep sense of commitment to the people and the family, the vulnerable children that were there. And that's the message I want to give to you too. These are not hopeless situations, because we have a powerful God. We have Jesus who is there. His heart beats for those in the margins. And as we celebrate Christmas and Easter, as we celebrate communion, the Eucharist, it's a moment where we say, God is broken for us. How do we respond? It means being willing to go to the margins, to respond, to see what we can do to bring light in darkness. Thank you for the part that you play here at 10th Church. Thank you for inviting me to share today. God bless you.